Leaning, safe and secure from all alarms. Leaning on the everlasting arms.
Leaning on Jesus, safe and secure from all alarms, leaning on Jesus, leaning on the everlasting arms. Wow, now that's an intro.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me today for this episode in which I'm going to be talking about Charles Laughton's The Night of the Hunter from 1955, a film, of course, starring Robert Mitchum and Lillian Gish. And I'm joined on this episode by my good friend, Mr. Tony Black. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Carl. What a pleasure to be on the Movie Palace. I've been listening intently since episode one, so it's a real privilege. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you say you've been listening intently, but I think if people have generally have been paying attention, they will have heard your name pop up a few times on the podcast. You kind of remind me of have you seen the film The Third Man with Orson Welles?
Oh, a while ago now, if I'm honest. Yes, I think so.
Well, he plays a character called Harry Lime, and this character's talked about all the while. He finally appears kind of late on. That's kind of what you're doing here, isn't it, I think?
I think a little bit. I feel like I should have remained like the Maris in Frasier, you know, and just never seen, just, you know, just the name pops up every now and then.
Yeah, and like the descriptions of you get more and more like elaborate.
Outlandish, yeah.
I mean, we should explain. I mean, you're my oldest podcasting mate, really, aren't you? Because,
oh yeah,
you know, if the studio system was around today, you know, you'd be a mogul, Tony. You got your fingers in a lot of podcasting pies, haven't you? And I guess the main, well, what we know each other from initially is the X-Cast, isn't it? And I think people who listen to the Movie Palace must be a bit bemused if they don't have any interest whatsoever in the X-Files, because it keeps coming up and up. But that's your kind of baby, isn't it? That's what you've been doing for a few years now, and it's really kind of taken off in like a tremendous way, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, it's become, I think, one of the most popular X-Files podcasts on the web now, which is great. It's been going about 3 years. You sort of jumped aboard, hosting, producing, getting involved around, I'd say, about 18 months ago or something like that, I think. And it's just really, especially over the last 18 months, really, it's really blossomed and bloomed. I'm going to give you the credit, to be honest, because it was pretty much at the time you and a couple of other people started joining in that it really sort of took off. But it's... yeah, it's just a show all about the TV show The X-Files, but it's, yeah, I've got my fingers in quite a lot of pies, but that is my baby, that one, and I think it's going to be with us for quite a while yet.
Yeah, well, not to get too like sappy on you or anything, but like it's your open approach is kind of inspiring, I guess. You know, you like to get lots of people involved and give people a chance and stuff, and I think, you know, it's a really nice way to run like a podcast, isn't it? So hats off, Mr. Black, I suppose.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. The reality is I'm lazy. And it's really great to get other people to do the work for me. No, I really like the idea of podcasts being a real community aspect. You know, I think I think anyone can do it, really. If you've got a mic, you've got some earphones, and you've got something you really want to talk about, I think, you know, I think it's fair game for anyone. So it's great. I just love connecting with people. It's great, you know, which is, again, one of the reasons I'm here, because this is how we met. So it's really brilliant.
Yeah, and even though like geographically we're not far apart at all,
no,
probably never would have you know, met without the X-Cast, and there is an X-Files connection to The Night of the Hunter, isn't there? Because the episode Beyond the Sea, you remember the character Luther Lee Boggs?
Yes,
he's got Kiss Kill, I think, tattooed on his knuckles, And Mitchum has love-hate, doesn't he, in the film, obviously.
I had never made that connection, actually. How interesting. No, I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, that's a great episode if anyone wants to get involved watching The X-Files. Beyond the Sea, it's well worth it. And if it's, you know, if that character reminds you of Harry Powell, then it's all for the better.
Just before we do dive into the film, I mean, like we said, you've got a few things going on. In terms of, like, your writing, I suppose the Cultural Conversation blog is the main thing there, isn't it? And, I mean, how would you kind of pitch that to people, kind of looking at the contemporary scene as stuff kind of grabs you, I suppose?
Yeah, and it's going to kind of migrate onto my entertainment website, Set the Tape, www.setthetape.com as well, which is where I kind of juggle my time, really. But, Cultural Conversation over the last year or so has been me variously, you know, pontificating on pop culture, really, TV, movies mainly, and reviewing things in depth. I think I'm a fan of the long read, and I'm a fan of the long write as well, which isn't always easy to do. It helps me with. I'm writing a book as well on pop culture mythology and things like that, so that all helps, goes into the pot really. But yeah, it's fun. I don't quite know how I get time to do it all, but it manages to happen somehow.
Well, yeah, because this is before we even talk about, like, day jobs and stuff, isn't it? But
oh, yeah, they just get in the way,
And, well, in terms of this film, I think it's going to be interesting to talk about that, because this is a film that had, like, a really interesting mixed critical reception. So, I'm going to pick your brains as kind of a reviewer later, I think.
Mm.
What about Set the Tape, then? Because that's just reached its kind of first year anniversary, hasn't it? So, again, kind of a nice pop culture resource for people who are kind of keeping up with new releases and stuff like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a mix of stuff, really. I mean, it's a bit broader than my blog. It covers, you know, comic books releases. It does things on sports sometimes, on gaming. But yeah, the core bread and butter is TV, movies, and we try and be as contemporary as we can or linked to certain things. But you know, it's year two, so myself and Owen Hughes, who I run the site with, we're always thinking about how to expand and do different things with it. But it's taking off. There's multiple things, and that, you know, the podcast stuff with the XCast and a few other things are going to expand as well next year. So it's just continually adding things to my list of things to do all the time.
All right then. So The Night of the Hunter. I mean, before you and I talk about it, Tony, one of our listeners, Andy Wolverton, got in touch, and before we speak about the film, he's going to give us a bit of a flavour of the story.
Hi, my name is Andy Wolverton, and I write for my own website, andywolverton.com, as well as The Dark Pages, the newsletter for film noir lovers. I'm also a public librarian in Severna Park, Maryland, where I host a program called The Great Movies every first Thursday of the month. My co-worker, Julia Roberts, not the Julia Roberts you're thinking of, take turns choosing, introducing, screening, and leading discussions of classic movies. Earlier this year, I chose Charles Laughton's The Night of the Hunter. The Night of the Hunter, based on the 1953 novel by Davis Grubb, is partially based on a true story. Robert Mitchum plays Harry Powell, a preacher of, let us say, questionable theological orthodoxy. While in prison, Powell meets a fellow prisoner named Ben Harper, played by Peter Graves, who tells Powell about the $10,000 he grabbed from a bank robbery, but he won't tell him where he hid it. Once out of prison, Powell seeks to find the money, and he believes Harper's children might know just where it is. It sounds like a fairly typical crime movie, but The Night of the Hunter is unlike anything you've ever seen before. It's a very strange film that includes elements of film noir, comedy, fantasy, and more. It's influenced by silent film and German expressionism, and has influenced filmmakers such as Martin Scorsese, David Lynch, the Coen brothers, and more. It was also the only film ever directed by Charles Laughton. You can read more about why he never directed another film by checking out the excellent book Heaven and Hell to Play With, The Filming of The Night of the Hunter by Preston Neal Jones. Now, the idea for the film came about when the movie producer Paul Gregory was sitting in a bar watching The Ed Sullivan Show on TV. That particular night, Charles Laughton was giving a dramatic reading from the Bible. Well, Gregory was so moved by the performance, he asked Laughton to go on a nationwide tour of America reading the Bible, which led to the idea of Lawton directing a movie about an evil preacher. And when you think about it, the film is actually shot from a child's point of view, which comes across in many scenes that are shot in incomplete landscapes. We see only the things that would be important to a child and very little else. Lawton himself called the film a nightmarish sort of Mother Goose story. He wasn't trying to make a realistic movie, but rather an impressionistic fairy tale told like a child's dream or nightmare. Few people understood it at the time, and it was a box office failure. I was a little apprehensive showing this to our Great Movies audience back in April. We've shown a lot of films off the beaten path and several film noir titles, but never anything like The Night of the Hunter. But I needn't have worried. The audience loved the film, and many of them confessed that this film changed their minds about Robert Mitchum's ability as an actor. Many of them said that they couldn't wait to see the film again, and I totally agree with them.
All right, then. So, The Night of the Hunter. I mean, the interesting thing here is, like, when I started this podcast, the first phase, I'm not even sure if I've properly explained this on the various episodes, but the first phase was going to be, like, people, you know, I said to people, what kind of films would you be interested in discussing, you know, and I think this was the first one, like, first title you tossed at me.
Yeah.
So what's your kind of personal history with this film, then? Is this one you've long been an admirer of?
Well, I mean, I've got to, I suppose, be upfront and admit, really, that I'm finding The Movie Palace some level of an education, because I've always been somebody who, pre-1960, I would say, or 1965-ish, my film knowledge has been sorely lacking in many ways over the years. I didn't grow up, you know, watching old movies. You know, I grew up as a child of like the 80s and 90s watching a lot of, you know, blockbusters and that kind of thing, really. So it's only as I've got older that I've started to explore more of this stuff. So, you know, some of my knowledge is sometimes a bit limited going this far back. But I remember watching Night of the Hunter for another podcast I did, a nascent sort of film podcast I did a few years ago. And I recorded an episode on it with somebody for about half an hour of it, actually, which he's still lying about somewhere. And I think it might have been based on their nomination, actually. I think I said, let's choose some classic films and talk about them. And this podcaster, I forget who it was, but they said The Night of the Hunter. And I'd heard of it, but that's when I watched it. So I'd say it was about three or four years ago. And I was just immediately spellbound by it, really. And it's one I picked up the Arrow Academy Blu-ray release from somebody on Twitter who was letting some Blu-rays go. And I thought, I know I'm going to get back to this at some point, and I want to see it on Blu-ray. I want to get extras for it. I want to dig into it more. So, yeah, when this came up, you know, when you did design the movie post, I thought immediately, straight away, it was Night of the Hunter. I want to do that again. I want to do it properly. I want to look into it. I want to find out more about it. So it really leapt out in that way.
Nice one. I mean, yeah, the Arrow Academy release, the Blu-ray release you mentioned. I mean, I crumbled, basically. I mean, I've got this terrible habit, which my significant other is not too fond of, where I'll upgrade something from DVD to Blu-ray, you know, just yeah. Whenever it comes up for a podcast or whatever, really. And I wasn't going to do it this time, but then I gave in. But it's a gorgeous release, isn't it? I mean, the film looks stunning on there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does, actually. It's in a, I think it's 1:166 ratio on the Blu-ray, and it's just crisp as anything, you know. And it, even though obviously it's black and white, it brings out the intense German expressionistic shadows of the whole thing, and you know, it seems like John and Pearl rowing down the river, and the stars, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous shot, but with on Blu-ray the stars just, you know, gape out at you. So it's gorgeous. It's remarkable what it does to a film with no colour, ultimately. It's great.
Yeah, well, with something like this, which is so kind of heightened and, like, artificial in a sense, you know, it definitely does. Again, I think we spoke about this at one point, but, like, I've got this terrible thing with extras where I desire them. You know, I really want the Blu-ray extras, and then I never watch them. And I saw there's, like, a 2.5-hour documentary on the disc, isn't there? I just didn't have time to watch it before we sat down here, you know. But, no, it looks like a good package.
It's really good. I mean, I confess, I've watched about an hour of the documentary, which is called Charles Lawton Directs, and it was compiled around 10 years ago when they I think it was National Library of Congress or something like that, got hold of a lot of stock footage, and they decided to compile a documentary together. And it's amazing, actually, because on that documentary, it's essentially working through, with narration, it's working through the history of the film, but also the production of the film. So it's so rare to see something from like the mid-50s where you have behind-the-scenes footage, basically, of them, you know, different cuts and, you know, them doing a scene and then cut and then interplay with the actors and going over and over things again and things like this. It's really unusual because it's the sort of thing you see nowadays, you know, in the fact that films and DVD releases are primed with, you know, everyone wants to see the behind-the-scenes footage. But it's so rare to see something from this era. And it's really well preserved as well. And you can hear Charles Laughton and see him sometimes coming in and giving direction and stuff like that. And it just works through the film in that way. And that's why it's 2 hours, 41 minutes. but it's really good. It's really well compiled, yeah.
No, I'll definitely have to give that a try. I mean, we're talking about your personal history with the film. I'll tell you kind of mine. I mean, I can't quite remember the first time I saw this. It was a while ago. But I do remember showing this film to my son. Right, this is terrible, actually. when he was five, right? And I was thinking the other day, I was kind of wondering what my mindset was. Why did I do that, you know? I was thinking, well, maybe because there's children in the film. You know, maybe, obviously, it's a disturbing film, but you've got this kind of fairy tale vibe going on. Maybe that's why I thought it was acceptable. Maybe, I don't know. Or maybe I was just trying to suggest to him, you know, look, if another man comes on the scene, you know, be cautious, you know.
Or maybe you were doing that thing, which I think is a dad license, in that you have a child, you have spare time. Oh, let's watch a film I love. You'll like this, child. That's certainly what I'm going to do when I'm a dad. Yeah. I'm going to do that. But no, I think there's the aspect of it. It's almost from, in many ways, it's from John's perspective anyway, you know, and it's from a very childlike perspective. So I think even though it's quite, it could be scary, I suppose, to a five-year-old. At the same time, I think, weirdly enough, they might find a way in at that age.
It definitely had an effect because, like, he's almost 11 now, and I said to him, like, the other night, I'm going to sit down and watch this film, Night Hunter. Do you want to, like, sit down with me? And he took one look at the Blu-ray cover, and he remembered Mitchum. So it stuck with him.
That's great.
Yeah. He didn't want to watch the film, though.
Give him time. Give him a few years. Yeah. He'll be all over it then.
This is it. This is a really hard film to like categorize, I think. It's quite hard to pin down exactly what it is in terms of like genre and stuff like that, because it's kind of a unique creation in a lot of ways. So, I mean, how would you describe it? You know, how would you kind of, you're trying to sit down with someone and explain to them what The Night of the Hunter is. What would you say?
It is tricky. I mean, it's been described as almost like a Southern Gothic noir in the past, and I think that even to describe it like that is relying on people having a certain level of knowledge of genre. Do you know what I mean? Even if that's the case, I mean, I think I tweeted about it, and I sort of described it as like a dark piece of Americana melodrama. I think it with lots of themes in terms of, you know, good and evil and light and dark and having that, like you said, that fairy tale aspect to it. But this is precisely, in my clear description, it's not clear. That's why it's quite unique and spellbinding from this, particularly this distance, because it is not easy to pigeonhole. You know, if it was made today, it would be one of those really unusual kind of pictures that everyone sort of sits up and venerates. Things like Under the Skin, you know, with Scarlett Johansson, where everyone goes, that's weird. That's not like anything else that's out there. You know, it would be one of those now, especially. And it was then. And that's why I think it didn't do very well, did it, ultimately? It was kind of shunned at the time.
I had a very mixed reaction, you know, and commercially didn't do well. And I think it's what you're saying, because it's kind of when something different comes along, it's quite hard to appraise, isn't it? I mean, in terms of like recent films, one that comes to mind for me, I mean, it's a very different film. You remember Mother by Aronofsky?
Yeah.
That's just another one where you imagine people sitting down to write about that film and they just don't know where to begin. And, you know, it might be in the fullness of time, people kind of reassess it or whatever.
It's funny. It's funny you should mention that, actually, because I think in some ways, I think there's some level of connective tissue between those films, between this and Night of the Hunter, because that too has you know, elements of biblical and religious symbolism and things like that. And it's got these primal characters. They're not the same, don't get me wrong, but, you know, you feel like films like that may have had some inspiration from Charles Laughton's film here.
No, I think that's a good point, actually. I mean, I'm in kind of the same mind as you, because I just kind of sat down, I thought, I'll write down the first words that come to mind about this film. I wrote down American Gothic, Southern Gothic, fairy tale, folk tale, melodrama, and, like, the thing is, it's like all of these things are different times, I think, you know. It's so strange, but it's also like a really lyrical film too, isn't it? I just think it's marvellous, and it's full of all sorts of weird contrasts, which I think we'll come on to, you know, but in terms of the way it uses, like, the stars that are in it, in terms of, like, the style of the film visually, and in terms of its themes, there's all sorts kind of, you know, all sorts of different things rubbing against each other in this film. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a real mishmash, you know, and you feel like frequently the film veers between, you know, even at times, like, really sort of a black comedy in a way, you know.
yeah, quite slapsticky at certain points.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it goes into these real, you know, creepy, even at that point, old-fashioned corners. Like, you know, I always think of the bit where the kids, they're down with Powell in the basement, and then they're trying to run up the stairs, and he comes after them like Nosferatu, you know, with his hands out, and he's just up the stairs, you know, chasing after them. And it's almost comic, but at the same time, it's really chilling, because he would kill them. I mean, this is the thing. There's no doubt in your mind as to the fact he would kill these children. And it's just a scary, it's a mixture of quite terrifying and strangely ethereal in a way. I mean, I think as well of the very beginning, where you first see Lillian Gish as like a floating head, and she's talking to all the kids, and she introduces the story almost, it's almost like a Greek chorus, you know, she introduces the story as that kind of thing. And it's set immediately, you know, that this isn't a straightforward thriller or chiller or anything like that. And also the other thing is that this is ahead of its time quite significantly. You know, this has a serial killer of women pretending to be a preacher going round with a knife in his pocket that when he's watching a strip show actually bursts out of his trousers. Like, I mean, you know, this is like, yeah, to me, it's like the next step from something like this is Psycho, you know.
Yeah, well, I agree, because I was thinking about that in the sense that in Psycho, the female lead, well, the nominal female lead, disappears after about 45 minutes. Mm. So here, Shelley Winters gets killed, and in Psycho, it's Janet Leigh.
Yeah.
And in this film, it's all about the money, you know, that's hidden away, and, you know, you've got the stolen money in Psycho. So, yeah, I was thinking about that too, to be honest. And in terms of being ahead of its time, it's also kind of a strong break from what's going on in the films around it, you know, of the same kind of era, in the sense that, like, I think American film was moving towards kind of naturalism, was kind of the order of the day, you know. So this film's like really artificial, very stylized, at a time when films are being shot more on location, acting styles are changing with, like, the method school coming through, you know, it's going towards kind of naturalism. And I think that's another factor when we think about why critics didn't quite know what to make of this film, or a lot of them didn't. You know, it's because it's kind of so much in opposition to what's going on around it, I think.
It's almost like someone now, like, say, Paul Thomas Anderson, making a film, you know, I mean, his most recent one, Phantom Thread, which, if you watch it, it's not like most films that are made in, like, 2017, 2018, you know. And he's an example of a filmmaker who classically sort of looks back to his idols and his kind of people like Robert Altman and these kind of people, you know, and he makes films that don't quite fit almost sometimes the time he's in, you know, things like Inherent Vice, which might as well be a Robert Altman film, really. And Charles Laughton was really inspired by silent film. You know, he was inspired by D.W. Griffith. He was screening D.W. Griffith films to the cast and crew and saying, you know, this is the kind of, you know, F.W. Murnau and all this expressionism. You know, he wanted to sort of tap into something that was, like you said, old hat. It was something that, you know, Lee Strasberg and the method were moving away from, and he wanted to create that sense of the theatrical, and that's why it's endured. You know, that's why it's endured more than a lot of similar films around the time, because it, with the distance, allowed, you know, the changing times of cinema to really see what it was trying to do, and the fact it's quite timeless, actually.
Yeah, well, it is absolutely. You know, the film's got this timeless feel. You know, even though it's set at like a specific point in time in terms of the depression and stuff, but it isn't kind of bound to it, I don't think, because it's kind of an aestheticized kind of depiction of it. And that fairy tale kind of feel it kind of achieves, I think it's very appropriate for the story. Obviously, like we said, it involves children. I think of, like, you know, just the fact that you've got this blend of influences, like you said, you know, so German Expressionism, like the Usher Shadow and stuff like that. But then you've got these kind of pastoral settings, you know, which are very kind of idyllic and stuff like that. Mm. So you wouldn't necessarily imagine you'd kind of juxtapose them like that, but he did, and it works really well. And like you said, the D.W. Griffith stuff, like there's a shot, isn't there, in the film? It's like an Irish shot where the camera kind of closes in into like a pinhole. Do you remember when it's on the kids in the cellar, I think?
Yeah, yeah.
And like you say, the film's a D.W. Griffith, and that's reinforced by Lillian Gish's casting, you know. And I think when I said about reviewers having a bit of trouble with this film, it's like because of this, I think. But for example, Francois Truffaut reviewed the film, and he said it kind of flounders a bit when it moves between all these different styles. But I can see the argument that it's a bit of a jumble, definitely. But I think I admire like the risk-taking element of it so much, but I just don't regard it as a problem. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because I suppose if you think about it, there is sort of halfway through, it sort of lurches into something else, really. It sort of goes from being this quite tense to sort of deceptive potboiler of, you know, what's happened to Shelley Winters, what, you know, these kids starting to figure out, you know, because we obviously know that Harry Powell is a bad'un. You know, we know from the beginning that he's a con man, that he's a murderer, and that he's playing these people in order to get this money. And John is the one who's starting to figure out the boy, that he sort of can see what everyone else can't. So, you know, the first half is sort of that. And then once it switches, once they get away, once they run away, it does become much more of a fairy tale. You know, and by the time they get to the character of Rachel, played by Lillian Gish,
yeah,
at that point it becomes, you know, you could look at Powell as like an early forerunner of the Terminator at that point. You know, he's, or something like Looper, or even, you know, which is going far ahead. But these characters who then are intending to stalk this, you know, this domicile in order to, you know, destroy these children, and he's that malevolent force then. So it sort of switches between the two, and it becomes then this, you know, this standoff between very much good, the saintly sort of Rachel figure, and evil, you know, the devilish Powell. So it weirdly works, and I think it's because you have this through line of the children, you know, because it is them at the heart of the whole thing.
Well, I think it's a testament to like Lawton's approach, really, because from what I've read, you know, he was very open, very collaborative. He worked very closely with Stanley Cortez, the cinematographer, somebody who'd worked with Orson Welles on stuff like The Magnificent Ambersons, you know. From what I've read, it was a happy production in general. I mean, I don't know if this comes through on the documentary you've watched part of, but like, I know Lillian Gish said that like there was kind of a purpose and a harmony on this set that she'd not really seen for a long time, you know. I mean, was that your sense from what you've seen on the Blu-ray?
I think largely. I mean, from what I can tell from what I've looked into, there were mixed reports. You know, there were some elements that were saying that Robert Mitchum was difficult because he was drinking heavily and he was abrasive, which wouldn't surprise me. You know, it's Robert Mitchum at the end of the day. But, you know, apparently he clashed very much with the producer as well.
Paul Gregory,
yeah. that's his name. And they hated each other. So, you know, there were certain aspects that were that were fraught, but it's probably unlike most, you know, like most films probably have those tensions. So I didn't get the feeling that it was a tumultuous, traumatic production in that sense. You know, the trauma for Charles Laughton came at the end, you know.
Well, no, yeah, supposedly very badly affected by the failure, you know, the commercial failure of the film, and ultimately didn't make another film, you know, sadly. But the story about Mitchum I heard with the producer is that he urinated on his car seat or something,
on his Cadillac, yeah. Believe which, you know, people have subsequently, you know, some people have denied it, some people have, it's one of those things. Apparently it was never really apparent on set, and from the footage you see, you know, in Charles Laughton directs, it doesn't come across in that, but you know, things can be edited, you might not see, you're not going to see the whole of the picture, so who knows. But I mean, the other point of not so much tension but concern was the script ultimately, because it was by a writer called James Agee, who adapted the book, the original book by Davis Grubb, I think his name is. Mm-hmm. And it was a beast. It was like 300 pages that he drafted in. But the majority, and there was a lot of debate over the years as to whether or not, it was Charles Laughton who wrote the script that was filmed, or that it was James Agee's, and subsequently, you know, the script was rediscovered long after Laughton's death, and it was pretty much agreed that Agee's script was just whittled down, really, in order to get to... I mean, the film's only an hour and a half, so, you know, it's amazing what they cut, really. You know, I'd love to read that script, that original script, and see what was in there, really, because it would have been a mammoth film. So I think, really, those are the only points of tension I picked up on.
Well, what I've also heard is, like, you know, they did go over budget by a couple of $100,000, and they had quite a constrained shooting schedule. So I think, like, Mitchum's arrest, apparently that's a scene that, you know, they did quite a good job at salvaging that in the editing room, where they'd kind of had to just grab what they could, because Mitchum was actually working on another film before they wrapped Night of the Hunter, apparently. You know, they only had a very limited time with him. Mm. And he came out on a couple of Sundays to help them finish off and stuff like that, is what I've heard. But I was just struck by what it sounds like Laughton's process was. It was very adaptive. You know, a lot of scenes apparently came together quite late in the day, and he liked people kind of chipping in with ideas and stuff. So I think you feel that spontaneity in the film. Like, you've got all these weird choices, and I'm not entirely fond of all of them. I am most of them, but like you mentioned, the floating heads at the start, I've never really liked that, to be honest. And I don't really like the Christmas card style sappy ending either, but my point is, like, I don't think they detract, because I think the overall impression is one of, like, you know, the film, it's kind of alive, it's spontaneous, do you know what I mean? Even if you could quibble at one or two little things, you know,
I think it's a remarkably assured debut, you know. And maybe it comes from the fact that Laughton understood acting, you know. I think that's a key thing, really. I think I've always been of the mind that the best directors understand acting. They may not always understand actors. I mean, you could look at someone like Stanley Kubrick, who most actors hated once they'd worked with him because he was such a taskmaster, but he understood how to get the performance that he wanted in all of his films. And I think Charles Laughton, with all his background, you know, in obviously in cinema and then in theatre, you know, I think he understands actors, and I think he understood how to get these amazing performances. And I think that's what it lives on. I think that's, you know, the film is a bit of a jumble. It's a bit of a hodgepodge. It has, I mean, the script is really good, and, you know, the dialogue is tremendous. I really do think that. Structurally, it's a bit all over the place, but I think it really does live and die on how these actors interpret this material, you know. And, I mean, Mitchum is mesmerizing for a start. So I think Laughton knew how to get that out of his actors.
Yeah, well, I think Laughton himself, you know, his performances, when he was at his best, he would give these, like, really, like, audacious performances, which I wouldn't say they were, like, caricatures exactly, but they were very, very full. They were almost like archetypal performances, you know. And there's a quote I came across where he talks about great acting being like painting, you know. And I think that must be, you know, that approach probably lends itself well then to directing, you'd think, wouldn't you?
Mm.
And he does seem to have a kind of a painterly approach to the material here too.
There's a flourish. There's quite a lot of a flourish, absolutely, to it. And even, like, much like a painter, it's all a bit all over the place until he refines it. And I think had he done more films, he may have refined his process. But as a first go, it's, you know, it's mighty good, really.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so many, like, great moments here. I mean, one that just immediately comes to mind when I think about this film is, you know, Shelley Winter's character dead in the car.
Yeah.
Underwater.
Yeah.
With her hair kind of drifting around and stuff. And when you read about, like, how they did that, like, this very elaborate setup where they're, like, bringing in wind machines to kind of blow her hair in the right way. And they've got a crane with, like, 8 sun lamps on it and stuff like that. And just kind of bold, isn't it? You know, you think if it's your first film, you'd be tempted to kind of, you know, make sure it comes in on budget, comes in on time, you know, but no.
Yeah, he just went for it, I think. And I think that's, yeah, again, I think that's the kind of thing that you wouldn't have got with somebody who was a technical person in the same way. I think had it not been somebody who had, you know, like you said before, been this quite, you know, exuberant actor, and, you know, what found a book that, you know, he really loved, and a story he really loved, and came at it that way, I don't know if you would have got that from a more of a working, jobbing director. You know, I think that's the special formula with Laughton.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for me, this film really takes off. It's with that river journey, really. It's kind of like,
yeah,
fantastical drift down river. It calls, anytime you have people going down the river in American film or in American books, I think of, like, Mark Twain and Huckleberry Finn and stuff like that. And from what I've read, a lot of these literary influences can be traced back to the book. I mean, I haven't read the book, but that's what I've heard. And yeah, like I say, I just think it really, I mean, it's great all the way through, don't get me wrong, but it's really, that's the point at which it sort of comes into its own for me.
Yeah, I think so. I think it kind of, you know, when we talked about earlier, that transformation into becoming a slightly different film, the stakes sort of get sort of increase, I think, and it becomes, and it's funny because it sort of in many ways moves away from Robert Mitchum in a lot of ways. He's in it a lot less in the second half. It switches to be much more about Rachel and her relationship with these children, and he just becomes this like I said, this malevolence, this force that he's coming for them, and it's more about because we know he's going to get there eventually, and it's more about the fear of that. And then, you know, scenes like the brilliant, my favourite scene is the sing-off, you know, which we alluded to at the beginning of this podcast, in which you've got Lillian Gish sitting in that rocking chair with a gun, you know, on watch while all the kids are asleep, and he's standing out there, you know, leaning just on the post. And it's just wonderful because, you know, chills because he moves the camera away, pushes through the window, and you see him there. And it's just so simply set up of these two diametrically opposing forces. And that's when it really, there's a lot of power to it, really, and a lot of menace and, you know, ominous, you know, terror.
Well, yeah, just before we get to like Mitchum and that, you know, this kind of battle between good and evil that's kind of going on. Yeah, you mentioned like the use of music, and I mean, I know you're very attuned to like film music and stuff like that. It sounds like you listen to a lot of soundtracks and, you know, and so on. And like what I was struck by just by reading up on the background of this film is like that Walter Schumann was on set, the composer, on set for most of the film. Lawton really wanted to involve him in the process, you know. I think the idea was that he could, by being on set, watching the scenes being performed, he could be thinking about the music as he was viewing it, really, you know. So I was just kind of, I was taken by that, really, that, you know, he really was collaborative, it sounds like, Charles Lawton. And yeah, did you have any more thoughts on like the music here?
Well, I mean, it just stands out as being pretty perfect, actually. I think in terms of it fits, not just obviously the songs, you know, and which are all work really well, but the fact that it has, the music has this, both this intensity, this operatic feel, and this playfulness to it that is really difficult to do. You know, Walter Schumann, he didn't live much longer after this film. You know, he was only in his 40s when he died. So he never, you know, he was in the golden age of you know, film composers, people like, you know, Alfred Newman, who did the 20th Century Fox Fanfare, and, you know, Alex North, and all these people who then went on to inspire people like Jerry Goldsmith in the 60s and John Williams and all these people who, you know, we revere now. Very, it would be very difficult for anyone to really do a perfect score to a film like this. So it makes sense that he was very interlinked with Lawton, because I think the best film scores usually come from strong collaborations with people who understand the material and understand what they can take from it on a musical, in a musical sense. And, you know, this film, it's funny because in some directors would have done this with minimal music, I think. They would have potentially tried to create this film without that. But can you really imagine like them rowing down that river without that chorus almost going on, and that, you know, that beautiful, you know, elegant music happening? I can't. I just don't think it would have worked as well without Walter Schumann's score.
No, I don't think so either. I think it's definitely, you know, an integral part of like the tapestry of the film. I think if you'd have took the same story and tried to play it naturally, you know, then I can maybe see how you'd move away from all this music. But I just don't, yeah, like you said, I don't think it would have worked in anywhere near the same way. All right, so Robert Mitchum is such an interesting figure. I mean, I'm kind of indebted here because a few weeks ago on the podcast, I was talking to Raquel Stetcher, and she recommended this book about Mitchum on the podcast, written by a guy called Lee Server. And I've just read a good chunk of it the last few days, and it really is a superb biography. What I've heard about Mitchum here is, I mean, Lawton's first instinct, apparently, he's sort of thinking of a few names. He thought Gary Cooper, first of all, which seems kind of odd, because he wouldn't have had the same sense of menace, I don't think. Laurence Olivier was a bit more of kind of a live prospect for the role at one point. Lawton apparently thought about that quite hardly, but what happened was United Artists kind of didn't want Olivier. So it ended up being Mitchum, and, you know, thank goodness it did. And it sounds like they generally had a good rapport, even though Mitchum had his issues where he'd sometimes turn up and they couldn't go before the camera because he was drunk or whatever. Oh, here's a story I heard. Yeah, Lawton called up Mitchum. He said, "I'm directing this film. There's a character in it who's a diabolical shit. And Mitchum said, present. I'm your boy, kind of thing.
I'm your boy.
And I, this is what I wonder, though, because I think for a lot of people these days, I think people come to Robert Mitchum through this film. And I think the element then that maybe gets lost is that this actually was a bit of a departure for him at the time. I'm not sure if you were aware of that or not, but he was normally kind of renowned for a much more low-key style of acting, you know, to the extent where I've even seen quotes from critics who said he doesn't even act at all, you know, from his earlier films. And then, like, this film, this performance is, like, anything but low-key, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I have, yeah. I confess I haven't seen a lot of his work before this, but I have read a little bit about that. And, you know, his general style seems to be, you know, I feel like people who then, you know, started to imbue the method, as we talked about earlier, later, people like De Niro and Dustin Hoffman and that kind of thing, I think they were inspired by Mitchum, you know, because I think he did have a sort of, he had such a presence and that ability to just exist in order to play a part. But in this role, he taps into that theatrical aspect. You know, I mean, how can you not when you've literally, the first scene is you driving a car talking to God. They're literally looking up and going, "Oh Lord, I'm going to go there, and you're directing me," you know. So you're tapping into that kind of broader themes as a character. You're gonna really go to a different place with it. And I think he manages. I think what he does so well is that he manages to make a character who is. I mean, it's sad that Harry Powell isn't really known as isn't higher up on lists of the greatest movie villains ever, because he should be. Because he, you can see so many characters have been inspired by this guy and by this performance. Because he manages to both be terrifying, chilling, and also downplay things when he needs to at the same time. It's a really, really nuanced performance. And he just holds, he's the centre of gravity. He holds the whole thing. And, you know, as great as Olivier was, you know, it's one of those you can't imagine it. You can't imagine anyone being better in this role than Mitchum.
I completely agree. And like you say about like the lineage of it, you know, I immediately think, you know, then Mitchum goes on a few years later, he plays Max Cady in the original Cape Fear. And like you mentioned De Niro, then De Niro plays Max Cady in the Scorsese remake, for example.
And Scorsese was the guy who funded the restoration of The Night of the Hunter as well. You know, he was heavily involved in preserving and keeping this film, you know, going, because he was such a fan. So, you know, it all just spirals round. It all, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, one of the nuggets I picked up in this book is, so Mitchum has a few scenes in the remake of Cape Fear, you know, and he turned up on set and Scorsese kind of impressed him because he'd said he'd seen like all 103 of his films or whatever it was at that time. And the really funny thing here, I think, is that Lawton actually made Mitchum turn it, you know, dial it down a bit. You know, it's this kind of bravado performance, but Lawton kind of supposedly didn't want to ruin his career, you know, because, you know, if he really was too unlikable, you know, he thought he'd be too closely associated with evil characters. He thought, like, women and children would, like, run away from him on the street and stuff like that. So it doesn't feel like a performance that's been reined in to me, though. I mean, I think Rachel Cooper, the character Rachel Cooper says to at one point, she calls him, like, a mad dog of a man. And I know what she means. Like, he definitely has got this animalistic quality, but he reminded me more of a wolf. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, he's kind of like the big bad wolf figure if it's a fairy tale, isn't he, I suppose?
Yeah. No, he is. He's the wolf at the door. He is the, you know, the bogeyman. He's the one who's going to get you at night, you know. But he's also ultimately a very slippery con man. You know, he's pretending, he's tapping into this, you know, reservoir of faith and pretending to be a man of God and having all these arch statements and, you know, the Lord will do this and the Lord will do that. And in reality, he's a murderer who just wants money. You know, he's the most mercenary kind of character out there, and he will just kill anyone. And the fact he kills women as well. I mean, it's just so challenging. You know, if they'd have filmed it differently, this film would have probably been banned for years. You know, the fact that Lawton cleverly manages to, you know, he just suggests things half the time. Like when you, at the beginning where, you know, the camera floats down to this house and then, you know, these kids find the body of a woman, but you just see the legs. You know what it means. She's dead. She's been killed, you know. And I think had, you know, he been a little bit more perhaps lascivious with it, or a little bit more tapping into the later kind of, you know, like we said with Psycho and later sort of horror films, I think this film would have struggled a lot more with the censors, and I think it would have been a lot more controversial, really, than it was. But because it's such a fairy tale, it manages to get away with it, weirdly.
Yeah, and there's like elements of suggestion. I mean, I'm desperately trying to get for a podcast these days without using the phrase phallic symbol, but I seem to be doing it a lot recently. Because, like, when I spoke to Darren Mooney about Gilda, we were talking about, like, we think there's an implied homosexual relationship in the film that they couldn't, like, address openly. And then I was talking to Brandon not long ago about Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, and I was sort of saying, I think there's this kind of incest theme that runs through it, you know. And this is also a very sexual film in its own way. And, you know, you get this sense that the preacher's got this, like, it's kind of like sublimated desire. He's kind of disgusted by his urges. But, like, the switchblade knife, so phallic symbol alert, you know, what kind of bursts through his clothing, like you said, you know.
But it wasn't through his crotch. You know, that was changed. It was through his pocket. And originally, that was in James Agee's script. It was supposed to be through his crotch. To be very literal, you know, yeah. this is a blade hard on. Yeah. But yeah, it was changed to pocket. But you know, you still get the idea. You get the idea ultimately. And then later on, when, you know, Shelley Winters wants a sexual relationship with him when they're married, and he's, you know, basically says, you are only a breeder of children. You know, he doesn't, it's either that he can't or he won't. And you know, the film leaves that a little bit ambiguous. You know, there could have been some element of impotence there as well, which could have been factored into his rage. You know, if you want to look at the psychology of the killer, you know, there could have been some element of impotence and rage built up from that, or it could just simply be, like you said, he's disgusted with these base urges that he feels. It's hard to say, and the film never quite explains that, really. It just puts it all out there and lets you decide, because it's not about that as such. But yeah, it is sexual. I mean, but then you think about it, a lot of these films weren't they? I mean, a lot of them, there was all that undercurrent of, you know, rippling sexuality in a lot of these old movies.
Well, no, this is the thing that if you look at some of the online, like, Facebook groups and so on, and people are always talking about how these old movies represented, like, good, clean fun. And what they mean, I think, is that because you don't have bloodshed, you don't have profanity, you don't have, like, on-screen sex. So in that sense, yes, but...
Doesn't mean it's not it's like, there.
No, it's like you said, and the power of suggestion can be very forceful indeed, you know. Mm. And, like, here I was kind of struck by, you know, it's two... Well, you get Willa, the character Willa on her wedding night, don't you? So she's, you know, having these sexual yearnings, you know. Also, the Ruby, I think her name is, later on in the film.
Yeah.
You know, is clearly interested in the men and the boys who want to take her out and stuff like that. So, like, I think in the book I was reading... I think Simon Callow talks about, like, there's this thread of, like, poison sex that runs through the film. And, yeah, I think that's the perfect, like, summation of it, you know?
It's interesting how, with the bit with Ruby, with the two lads, I mean, this is set in the Depression. You know, this is set in the 1930s in a very sort of folksy Americana sort of landscape. But, you know, you got to remember, this came out in 55. This was on at the turning point of the very beginnings of counterculture after the war. You know, you've got the early strings of rock and roll starting to creep in, you know, in the mid-50s and things like this. So this film is, it almost feels like it's on the cusp of sort of suggesting that you've got this youth now who are going to come through and start to change things. Even though it's, the film is set 20-odd years earlier, you know, it may not have been, there may be some element of the era and the time it was filmed in there as well.
And I'll tell you another element I've heard suggested in terms of, like, we're talking about the preacher's urges and stuff like that. So there was a writer, Charles Tatum Jr. This is what he suggested. I'll just throw it out there, see what people think, you know, that he was sort of saying there's these overlaps between the preacher and Charles Laughton himself, you know, because Laughton, like, his film career had kind of foundered a bit. He was making a living from doing these dramatic readings, you know, on stage and stuff. So both characters are making a living from reading from texts like the Bible, basically. Both very lustful men with urges that couldn't be openly addressed, because I think with Laughton, he was married to Elsa Lanchester, but he was homosexual, you know, and apparently, not just that, but had a very, very strong sex drive, you know. So, I don't know, I'd never thought about this, even though I'd heard a few of these things about Laughton, but the fact that maybe he saw some of himself in the preacher is kind of an interesting idea, just to think about, even if we don't fully, like, subscribe to it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there could be aspects there, absolutely, you know, and... He did seem like a fascinating creature with that, in terms of the undercurrent of sexuality in him as well. You talked about the Bible readings. You get that actually on the Charles Laughton directs.
Yeah,
it opens with him, with the footage of him reading the Bible, and you know, you can tell it's live because he's stopping and starting and things like that. And it was after that. It was after that, one of those Bible performances, that Paul Gregory got in touch with him, and they started this collaboration. Then so it was so that's kind of the seed of the whole thing, really.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, in terms of like I said, this film, for me, it kind of kicks into even higher gear when we get to the river and beyond. And I think it's because it sort of, then it boils down to this kind of good v evil thing, doesn't it? Where you've got these competing personifications. You've got Harry Powell and Rachel Cooper, you know. So it's not too hard to sort of think about this film as like an allegory where the preacher, you know, supposedly he's a man of God, but he represents the devil, I think, or like a foot soldier of the devil. And then Rachel Cooper, by contrast, is like angelic. And, you know, I just love it that this film becomes this like earthbound battle between these different like spiritual visions almost. And do you know what it reminds me of? I mean, Tony and I, listeners, are both big fans of a semi-obscure 90s TV show called Millennium.
Yes.
Tony, do you see what I'm saying? There's kind of a millenniumistic sense there, isn't there?
Definitely. Without going into too much detail, Millennium was a show all about a former FBI profiler who was there was a sort of latent psychic aspect to his investigations, and that he projected himself into the mind of these people doing these terrible murders, and every week he was solving a different case. And usually the killers had sort of Harry Powell-esque psychology. You know, they had this repressed rage or this repressed sexuality, or they would frequently be pretending to be you know, men of faith, you know, or con men and things like that. And also, running through that show, you have this idea of and, you know, good and evil, and the idea of demons and this dark malevolence on Earth influencing the will of people. And it's not in a comic book sense. It's very much the evil that men do, and the real monsters are man in many ways. And that, yeah, it does feel that way, because you do get to a point where you've got, I mean, it's a fairly, you know, in modern standards, it's a fairly obvious sort of parallel, really. Now, if you look at it, you know, and you think about the iconography of it, but, you know, it doesn't make it any less impactful. It doesn't make it any less interesting, you know. You know more about classic cinema than me, Carl, but they did this very often, you know, in American cinema. You know, I don't think you really saw this. You know, especially a man of faith who's murdering women, you know, it feels like it was sort of blending all these things together in a way that, again, it was quite ahead of its time. Again, it was the kind of thing that you would get more of as cinema sort of developed into taking more risks and to sort of depicting the dark world around them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think it's very daring, actually. Yeah, I mean, what I like about it in terms of the religious aspect, I mean, there's a take on it you can kind of graft onto it, where like the film starts off in the Old Testament and ends up in the New, in the sense that, you know, Harry Powell's this very kind of blood and brimstone kind of Old Testament figure, isn't he, the way he preaches, you know. So you go from this violence at the start of the film. By the end, I said I didn't like the Christmas card style ending, you know, like the kind of sentimental ending, but that's more of like, you know, a New Testament calm that's been established at the end. So I think it's always kind of fun to kind of grapple with these kind of metaphors and allegories and so on. Even, you know, religion is something I'm not as like knowledgeable about as I should be, you know. So I quite like it when it's kind of writ large, like it kind of is here, you know.
Yeah, it's that sort of metaphysical sort of operatic battle between these forces. And it never becomes a supernatural thing, you know. You never get the suggestion that Harry is a demon or anything like that. It's nothing like that. It is very much the fact you have the purity. It's all about the corruption of children, ultimately. It's about either, you know, Rachel's protecting these, you know, youthful souls, and Harry Powell is the hunter. You know, he's the one stalking them. He's the big bad wolf at the door, as we've said, who's trying to eat them in order to get what he wants. And that's, it's a very primal story, I think, but it's wrapped up in this real concoction of, you know, these grand arch, you know, delivery, this wonderful theatrical dialogue, you know, the depression setting, which fuels all these different characters. I mean, you've got to remember that the whole thing is triggered off by the fact that John and Pearl's father, Ben, played by a young Peter Graves, who was in Mission Impossible later on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He goes to jail and he's killed and he's hung because he killed two men in a bank robbery because he was angry that, you know, the depression had led people not being able to feed their families. You know, he was almost like a weird sort of Robin Hood figure if Robin Hood went wrong. You know what I mean? He'd kind of, and then he passes the money down to John and Pearl and he says, don't tell anyone about this. This is for you. This is, you know, and then he quite happily goes off to the gallows and then you don't see him again. And Harry picks up from that. So it's, you start with a guy who is trying to be a good man and ends up getting it wrong. And then his children are almost corrupted by the complete opposite. And it, so it's interesting that the film starts with that and then through the prism of John and Pearl takes us through that journey to where they ultimately find that salvation with a truly good person, Rachel.
Yeah, well, I was going to say about her, because again, this is something that I wonder if it probably plays a lot differently to like people coming to this film today, in the sense that I imagine people just see Lillian Gish there and think, oh, this kind of kindly, benevolent old woman. But I think at the time, like, one of the things I'm really interested in is, like, I think when you use a star in a film, it always kind of signifies something. And, like, I think it's the fact she was this big star from the silent era, you know, films for D.W. Griffith, The Birth of a Nation, Broken Blossom, stuff like that. But she'd worked more sporadically in the sound era. So, again, it's like Lawton's reaching back into the past. Like, we've talked about his variety of influences, you know. And I think, again, you can suggest that in regards to her casting, you know. So he's reaching back into the past to kind of realise his vision. And I don't know, it just feels like she's got this kind of, like, this kindly nature, obviously, very maternal, very compassionate, but she's also got, like, a real authority in the role that serves it very well, too, I think. Especially when she's brandishing a gun and stuff like that.
Yeah, she's a badass, you know. She's almost like a forerunner for the kind of, you know, final woman, final girl kind of template, you know, the woman at the very end, you know, the Ellen Ripleys of this world, the people who take on the monster ultimately at the end. She's like a forerunner of that, really. And she deserves to be remembered so, really. And, you know, but she's also tough on them. You know, there's the scene where they're all, I think Johnny's larking about and she takes him behind a bush and literally tans his hide. You know, so
that's right.
You know, she's no messing. But ultimately, she's kind, she's maternal. She talks about how she lost a son and she kind of then decided to be essentially become a steward for these wayward children, these lost souls. And that shows the purity in her as well. So she's... It's the dichotomy, you know. Powell lies about doing the Lord's work. She kind of is, you know, in that sense, and that's why she ultimately is able to sort of vanquish him. Although I think perhaps that's where the film falls down. I think sort of at the end, I don't think it really knows quite how to end it all, you know. And so he's sort of captured and carted off. It's quite a damp squib, really. I think it sort of loses the punch towards the end.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's because, like I said, that scene I believe was done kind of pretty quickly. And I think you're right. I don't think that quite has the heft of what came before it, does it?
Mm.
But yeah, let's think just a little bit before we kind of start to wrap up and stuff. Like, this had a really mixed reception overall on first release. I mean, it did get some good reviews. It also got some really bad ones, you know. And just, you get the general sense if you read a few of them, people didn't really know what to make of it. It took about 20 years or so to become an established classic. Even I read a piece by Roger Ebert on the film written in 1996, and he's saying there, he says, this film has never received the attention it deserves. I was quite surprised as late as that he was saying something like that, you know.
Mm.
So it's really solidified its reputation, I think. And I was just thinking, yeah, like we were saying at the outset, you know, you review new stuff and, you know, Set the Tape reviews new stuff and stuff like that. I don't know, you get this instant rush to judgment on films these days. I mean, you always have had reviews, obviously, but these days you have things like Rotten Tomatoes, Metacritic and stuff like that. You get to a point very early on where you get a critical consensus on things, don't you? But I think something like Night of the Hunter shows that an instant appraisal can be very different to kind of history's verdict, can't it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Because I think at the time, you know, it was mismarketed, you know. They didn't really know what to do with it. It was classically one of those films. You know, you do get that now. You get that with films when they have no idea what it is, how to sell it to people. And then they either just... They get a bit of luck, or they get word of mouth, or it just dies, you know, and then it becomes, then it's discovered, then people start talking about it, and people start going, wow, have you seen Under the Skin? Have you seen Mother? You know, that, you know, it's really good. I mean, I didn't love Mother, just as a sidebar. I thought it was too out there, but, you know, Under the Skin was a good example of one that they had no idea how to put that out to people, really, except the fact it was Scarlett Johansson, you know, as a big star.
Yeah.
But, you know, word of mouth, you know, it's this kind of film I always say to people, watch that film. It is really different from anything else. So it's one of those things, I think, had Night of the Hunter been made later, I think maybe it would have been appreciated sooner, you know, because you've got to remember there was a big gap between this and the age, really, where people started having the forums to discuss, you know, pop culture and movies in the same way, you know, and obviously now, you know, everything's sliced and diced immediately. But, you know, it's interesting as well that James Agee, I mentioned earlier, he was a film critic, the writer, the guy who
That's
wrote
right,
this,
yeah.
You know, and he ended up, he was a really famous, really well, you know, he was the kind of like the, you know, the Roger Ebert of his day in the late 40s, you know. So it's interesting to, you know, that somebody like that went on to write a film, which then on has been picked up by lovers of film a lot later, and people who now will turn around and go, you want a great old movie? This one.
Mm. All right, then. So we've got a few listener comments about this film before we go. I mean, did you have anything else on the film itself you wanted to kind of chip in, though, before we get to the listeners?
Watch it, everyone. Well, presumably you've watched it if you're listening to this, because we've just told you the whole plot. So, but watch it again. Anyway, it's great. No, I think it's one of the best films of the 50s. And admittedly, I haven't seen all the films in the 50s yet, so you know, there might be a few that overturn it for me. But I think it's one of the most beautifully sort of stark and bleak and odd, ethereal films ever made. And I love it. I think it's one that will always work on repeat viewing.
Totally. I'll tell you a nice little rabbit hole you could go down. Now, when we're talking about Scorsese, and when Robert Mitchum died, Martin Scorsese issued a statement. He said, like, Robert Mitchum was film noir, you know. So I think if you find some of the Mitchum film noirs, like we're going to be doing Out of the Past on the podcast
cool.
in a few weeks. So that's a really good one. And that would be a good starting point. It's stuff like Angel Face. So, yeah, Mitchum's a great star. He died, actually. It's funny. Well, not a funny story. It's a sad story. But he died, and then the following day, Jimmy Stewart died. So you had kind of like the Rebel and the Hellraiser die one day, and then, you know, the kind of everyman figure died the following day. Like a real sense, it was like an end of an era kind of thing, you know.
Definitely.
Anyway, yeah, so we had a few listeners who chipped in about the film. So Ashley Westmoreland said, one thing I always remember is how the movie uses visual hints to pay homage to different aspects of horror, like Mitchum's jerky movements and outstretched arms as he chases the children up the stairs. Very Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah, yeah, there is a bit of Frankenstein, definitely about it. Yeah, he just needs the bolts in his head.
Well, we were talking about him as like the Terminator kind of figure, but you can also see him as like a forerunner for these kind of slasher film
yeah.
villains, can't you? Where he's, you know, Jason Voorhees or Freddy Krueger or whatever.
For sure.
You know, it's the same kind of unstoppability, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, that, yeah, primal force that's just going to slaughter you.
You can't reason with it.
Yeah.
You know. All right, so Raquel Stetcher also got in touch. She said, I love how The Night of the Hunter uses music. The scene where Robert Mitchum sings Leaning on the Everlasting Arms and Gish sings it back is one of the creepiest moments in movie history. Gives me the chills every time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course it's now possibly one of the creepiest moments in podcast history thanks to our opening.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt about that. Absolutely.
All right, who else? So Erica D said, the image of Shelley Winters underwater is something that will never leave me. I love the shadowing that Lawton uses, almost akin to some of the forms you find in a Tim Burton film, specifically Beetlejuice. And yeah, I mean, Burton's another one, isn't he? Like, I've never been a massive Tim Burton fan for whatever reason, but, you know, again, very highly stylized, very artificial. So I think it's definitely a valid comparison, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm the same on Burton. I've never really fell in love with him. But, you know, you only have to look at something like Ed Wood, you know, and kind of what he does with that. Obviously, that's black and white. But yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
And just the last one, so a quick one from Sean, who said, Spike Lee must be a fan as there is the love-hate fists homage in Do the Right Thing, which kind of brings us full circle, because like we said, there's also that homage in The X-Files that we're both familiar with too, isn't there?
So
kind of a nice note to stop on, I suppose.
It just proves that it resonates. You know, that you don't necessarily have to have seen the film to have seen pop culture lampooning the love-hate thing, you know, or some aspect of this film that has travelled through the ages. And then it's just nice now that the film itself has been rediscovered by a lot of people.
Go and watch this film, people, if you haven't already.
Absolutely.
It really does hold up. Really does.
Yep.
All right, Tony. So social media and stuff like that. I mean, active on Twitter, aren't you? Active on Facebook as well. Where are the best places for people to find you?
Right. We might need an hour. AJ Black Writer, at AJ Black Writer on Twitter is where I mainly am on Twitter. There's also, as I said, www.setthetape.com, which is also on Twitter, at SetTheTape. We also have a Facebook page. And then if you are an X-Files fan or you fancy getting into it, check out at the X_cast on Twitter and the X-cast both page and Facebook group, which is called the X-Files Basement, on Facebook if you want to get involved in our community. But yeah, that's mainly where I hang about, really. But there'll be more new things out there. So if I'm lucky enough to be on the show again, there might be one or two more handles for me to talk about. But watch this space.
Yeah, well, what we forgot is by the time people hear this, people will have heard you like talking with me about Singing in the Rain in kind of a bonus episode I'm going to put out.
Yes.
You know, we talked about it ages ago, didn't we? And the podcast never quite came to fruition, did it? But we managed to use it here, so it was great.
Yeah, much, much better venue for it than I ever would have had. So I'm glad it's found a good home.
Yeah, well, hopefully you'll be back before Christmas for a podcast that will be practically perfect in every way. But we'll see. And quite a massive diversion from Night of the Hunter as well.
It could even be described as supercalifragilistic expialidocious, Carlo, if that's not giving too much away.
Right. First listener to guess the film doesn't get any prize whatsoever.
Because it's
too
obvious.
Easy,
but, yeah, I cannot wait for that one. I cannot wait.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to that one. But yeah, listeners, you know, keep your eyes on social media. This is quite a dark time for the podcast because we're doing lots of dark films. We're going to be doing lots of film noir in November, you know, and then December's going to be a bit lighter, guys, I promise. So in any case, I hope you can join us next time when the curtain rises once more at the Movie Palace.
Bringing in the sheaves, we shall come rejoicing. Bringing in the sheaves, we shall come rejoicing. Bringing in the sheaves.